You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Hotep, and greetings to all of you, my brothers and sisters, and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, Dr. William Rogers. Thank you so much. This is our first program of the 2021 season. We thank you so much for being with us here today. Very exciting program. Very interesting dialogue that is going to take place very shortly. We appreciate you tremendously. We hope that your new year is off to a good start, that you have become productive already, and in light of all of those things that are going on around us, it's just amazing. My guest tonight and I are both from two areas of the country that are in the headlines. We are leading the country in headlines, and we just mentioned that very briefly. But that's not the reason we're here. We're here to talk about a very dynamic brother, a literary genius by the name of James Baldwin. And I have with me tonight a young lady who is a Baldwin scholar. I am so fortunate to have her here tonight with me. And we're going to talk about my good brother, and plus as well as some of the things that she is doing currently, which I'm also very, very excited about. So my guest is Dr. Stephanie Dunn. Dr. Stephanie Dunn. Good evening, Dr. Dunn. How are you?
Hello. How are you? Thank you for having me on. And I don't know about Baldwin scholar, but I certainly have lived and breathed this brother who has been so influential on me.
Exactly.
As a writer and a thinker for as long as I can remember.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, how that came about is I wanted to do this conversation. One of the things that had influenced me was I had just completed reading Herb Boyd's book about Baldwin's Harlem. And I was moved by that writing. And also the film Raoul Peck did not too long ago on...
I Am Not Your Negro.
Right, I Am Not Your Negro. And so all of that sort of inspired me a little bit. And then just talking to friends. So I said, you know what, I wanna talk about that on our program. See, our platform... A lot of our listeners are educators, they are students, they are just grassroots folks, and they are here and they are learning. Sometimes one of my good brothers who's online now, he said he comes to our program every evening with his paper and pencil. So he's taking notes.
Beautiful.
And that's good, and I'm glad. So I wanted to do that. I wanted to talk about Baldwin in a way to see if where we need to place him in terms of the pantheon of powerful black men and women who have who shape and mold our history. And so this is one of my reasons. So I was looking for somebody, and I called a couple of friends and said, do you know anybody that is proficient in James Baldwin? And most of the folks said no. And I said, some of my colleagues from the university that I worked, I called them. I said, are you real proficient in Baldwin? They said, no, I can't. I know Baldwin. I read his stuff, but I don't think I can handle that. I said, okay, all right. So then I called a very good mutual friend of yours and mine, Professor Reginald Muhammad, who was on our program a couple of weeks ago. He talked about his book on reparations. And I said, brother, you know anybody that's proficient on James Baldwin? He said, oh, man, my brother. He said, I got the scholar. He said, I got the Baldwin scholar. I said, ooh. And then he told me who you were. I said, oh, Brother Reginald, please help me get her. He said, okay, I'm going to make a couple calls. I'll make a couple calls. And that's how it came about. And, you know, I didn't know.
Well, Brother Muhammad doesn't usually get a no, so he was.
Right. So he pumped this up. He pumped you up real good. He pumped you up real good. And then I didn't know. I had talked to your husband about 2 weeks ago, also about coming and doing some things with Brother Nasir.
Yes, indeed.
He wanted to do some things with me, but you know, he said he had a little tight schedule, but we're going to get it together. We're going to make it happen.
Oh, yeah, you got to have him on because he's a walking history book, that one. So but I'm glad to be on here talking about Baldwin for sure, whom I have such an affinity for. So.
Good enough. I'm going to let our listening audience give you a little background about our wonderful guest that we have this evening. Again, as I said, her name is Dr. Stephanie Dunn. She holds a PhD, a Master of Arts, and a Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Notre Dame. She is a writer, filmmaker, professor, and cultural critic. She teaches African-American literature and culture, creative writing, and cinema at the great, powerful Morehouse College, and is co-founder and the academic coordinator for the Morehouse Cinema television and emerging media program called C-STEM sometime. She is a frequent moderator and host for discussions of race and gender in and is the author of a book. Hold your hats, my brothers and sisters. The name of the book is Bad Bitches and Sassy Supermamas, Black Power Action Films. I love it. University of Illinois Press, and the forthcoming novel, Snitchers. Her essays and commentaries about the politics of race and gender in American culture have appeared in edited books and a number of publications, including Ms., The Chronicle of Higher Education, CNN.com, The Atlantic, Vogue.com, The Root, Ebony, and NPR, among others. She is the 2016 Eleanor Taylor Bland Crime Fiction Writers of Color Award. She was awarded for her forthcoming novel, manuscript, Snitchers. Her screenplay is Chicago 66, is the 2020 Finish Line Tirada Social Impact Screenwriting Competition winner. Brothers and sisters, we have got a winner here with us today, and I am so, so, so happy. So with that, Dr. Darren, are you ready?
I am. Okay. Yes, indeed.
And we,
yes, sir.
A lot to our audience, I also say we have taken out several things that we normally do. And the reason that we've done that is because we want to spend as much time as possible talking to my sister here tonight. And so that's why we have foregone some of the normal formalities that we do in the beginning. So this is real critical for us. Okay, Dr. Dunn, one of the things that has often been said about our good brother James Baldwin, that he was an enigmatic figure, and that he was, in some cases, confusing about things, and was misunderstood in a lot, misinterpreted in some ways, and there hadn't been really a good, clear description of just who Baldwin is and what he meant, as I said earlier, to the pantheon of Black literary geniuses that we know that have shaped our history today. So I want to start off, first of all, so that our audience would know, what would a literary scholar do, and what would they know, what would they bring to the table and when you're looking at a figure like a James Baldwin? What is it that you're taking in consideration?
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, one of the basic things is that Baldwin represents a multi-layered intellectual, literary scholar, activist, sort of resume. And what I always found so magnificent about him, you know, other than obviously his mastery of language and prose and his ability to I think deal with the psychological as well as social implications of race in America and so on, mm-hmm. is that he wrote in a number of genres. So he was a playwright, mm-hmm. obviously he was, you know, a very famous essayist, a short story writer, a novelist. So writing in multiple genres, because I think those each had something for him that helped him to express in different ways, because each of those genres are unique as part of the literary tradition. And so I think that he was expressive in so many genres because, you know, the weight of what he was dealing with or trying to deal with, trying to think out, if you will, think out loud to us with, right?
Exactly.
Really found expression distilled through those different mediums.
And he did that. I mean, he clearly did that. I've read most of his books. I haven't read all of them, but I've read most of them.
It's quite prolific, right?
Yeah, really,
I mean, because we start with that little essay that upset Richard Wright,
you know,
back in 1948.
Yep, exactly.
Everybody's protest novel,
And it's so interesting because my graduate work was in the Harlem Renaissance. I did intellectual history approach to that 135th Street Library, and I encountered a lot of things about Baldwin in letters that you know, I would run across. I was working on Ernestine Rhodes, who at the time was the librarian of the 135th Street branch, prior to Schomburg's collection being taken there. And it was just interesting how, as I read more into the latter part, we kept crisscrossing with Baldwin, and very clearly the first major crisscross in that era was Richard Wright. And I would have liked to have been a Wright scholar. I used to love the works of Richard Wright. So it seems that he was influenced by Richard Wright. Am I correct?
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, you know, as a young man, 24, I think, right?
Yes.
He flees America and goes to Paris following, you know, the tracks of Richard Wright, you know, and other expatriates. And Wright was, you know, really a mentor and a sort of, you know, literary, you know, father, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Then, of course, that's why it made it even more interesting when Baldwin Pope does his essay, which is a critique of Native Son,
right,
which appears in the little journal Zero back in 48. And then he and Wright end up having, you know, some words exchanged, shall we say.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right off.
I read about that.
But yeah. Critiquing yeah. Native Son.
Exactly.
But anyways, I mean, yeah, so he goes to Europe, and Europe was a very important, you know, sort of release for him, in terms of putting, I think, the distance necessary between American racism, you know, and himself. And so, a number of, you know, the writings were begun there or written there. His first novel, was Go Tell It on the Mountain.
Right.
I think
exactly.
That was 53.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he had, of course, later on the essays, you know, Notes of a Native Son.
And, right.
And then he goes on to the second collection of essays, Nobody Knows My Name. And then, of course, no, the other novels, Giovanni's Room and Another Country in the late 50s and early 60s, I think, was Another Country.
Exactly.
And then, of course, The Magnificent, The Fire Next Time, the mm-hmm. essays
oh, yeah.
in 63, which became his best-selling right essay work. Put him on the cover of Time magazine. So
that's right. Just for the for our audience, just to kind of give you a time and place analysis of things, Baldwin was born in 1924, and so we're talking about a young man around that's beginning mm-hmm. to get into that world around 1939, correct? Because he's at about 15, 16, he started this strong interest. In literary writing, am I correct, Dr. Dunn?
Yeah, well, you're correct. August 2nd, I believe, 1924. He was born.
That's right.
Grew up in Harlem.
In Harlem,
which
yep.
was an important part of shaping who he was and his, you know, literary sensibilities to come. So he grew up in Harlem, and he was at first sort of identification, if you were. Was as a young preacher, as a teenager,
right,
sort of became
right.
a sensation. And, you know, he writes a little bit about that, you know, the kind of, the volatile relationship with his father, the Reverend David Baldwin, and how he sort of, you know, eclipsed his father by becoming this teenage preaching sensation.
Right.
at the time.
Exactly.
And then was the evolution into his literary, you know, identity, but the preacher, the young evangelist, if you will, was the first kind of identification, if you will, while he was still a teen.
Mm-hmm.
And then he began writing, you know, by the time he was in his early 20s, absolutely, he was writing, and he had gone to Paris by the time he was 24.
Right, exactly. And I want to ask you about that, too. But I just want to let our audience also know, so what we're saying here about Baldwin is he's writing, he is growing and developing during the age of the Harlem Renaissance. You know, Wright, Langston Hughes, County Cullen, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Marcus Garvey, all of them were operating in this time frame. Booker T, W.E.B., all of this is Baldwin's growth era, you know, and he's growing. He's coming again. He's born in 1924, and so, you know, These are people that he would know and recognize, and his education. So I want to kind of put that time frame for you so to help you understand. So so one of the things that we very clearly know, as you said, he encountered in his younger years, as I understand, as the Brother Boyd talked about in his book, a lot of racism in Harlem, and he wanted to get out, wanted to go somewhere else and live. Why do you think he chose Paris?
Well, you know, Paris by 48 had become, you know, the place where okay. a lot of Black artists, you know, performers had gone. And so it was really sort of by then, I think, this kind of icon of a certain sort of bohemian artistic, you know, freedom. I mean, you had had Wright and Josephine Baker and, you know, and quite a number of folk who had gone to Paris, and also white artists as well, I should say. I mean, Baldwin did settle in Greenwich Village as a young man before he went to Paris. And so there was that, you know, the writers there and the poets there, you know, and the intellectuals there. He was, you know, mixing with a lot of folk who were of different racial ethnicities who were, you know, budding literary, musical, you know, artistic folk. Mm-hmm. And so he followed a long path of people, Black expatriates before him, to Europe, to Paris, like Wright in 1948. I mean, it was his first time there.
Right, right. And they accepted him. They sort of embraced him. Now, it seems that he had a lot of guidance, support. I know Mr. Boyd talked about the relationship with one of his school teachers that took him under her arms and did some things with him. Would you say that, how would you label him in his development years? Was he a writer that was addressing the issues of African people, or was he just a writer who wanted to address whatever was going on in America? How would you look at that? How would one consider that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I don't think that I would not be able to separate those things in his writing. I mean, from earliest on, remember when he wrote of Wright's Native Son, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it had everything to do still with thinking about race, literary tradition, art, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So
right.
I don't think these things were separable from him, you know, from his intellectual literary material. Do you know what I mean? Because this had shaped him. I mean, as a young Black boy growing up in Harlem, witnessing what he had witnessed in terms of American racism, not only sort of externally on a national scene, but in terms of his personal life, the influence of it on his father. I mean, he made those connections, right,
sure did,
between
sure
how American racism sort of could warp the psyche. I mean, you know, so it was not something that I would say he tried to either. That was ever sort of not something that figured into the theme that he undertook in much of his work.
I got you. Okay. Because, you know, I'm thinking about what was coming to mind. Is I remember a lot of those Harlem Renaissance writers were embracing the philosophical systems of existentialism, and you know, because Wright very clearly was playing around with that idea. Communism was something that was at the table as well, and I remember in Wright's book called The Outsider. You know, he explored that existentialist philosophy deeply. And so if Baldwin is, you know, if they're sort of mentors for him, I was wondering if he probably got into some of that as we look at the world. Because, you know, Pan-Africanism was the big deal in Harlem. You know, and he obviously, I don't think I could say his writings were Pan-Africanist in a big way. He might have had some tenets of it, but clearly defined way. So I was just wondering about him choosing Paris, because he could have done, and maybe it was too early at that time, he could have done what Du Bois did and went to Africa if he was trying to get away. So I was just wondering, did that identify anything about him which you know about what some of his critics have said. And could that be a reason for people misinterpreting a lot of his work? Is that kind of clear where I'm going with that?
Yeah, it is. Although, you know, I mean, with Baldwin, this is somewhat complex, because we can talk about Baldwin in two phases. One is, you know, is Baldwin, obviously, while he was alive, and he's actually writing as still, you know, a young writer in, you know, the 50s and 60s, right? Maybe up until the 70s, because in the 70s, you know, there was two of his essay collections, as well as two of the novels, including The Bill Street to Talk. Mm-hmm. But then there is post Baldwin's death, and the 21st century, where now there is sort of the revisiting of Baldwin, I think more of a sort of awakening appreciation of the consciousness that he had, and the intellectual largesse, demonstrated in his writing. That's happening now. But some of what impacted, you know, Baldwin, you know, had to do also with the homophobic nature of American culture and of Black American culture, to be honest. Some of those politics played into the reception of Baldwin in different communities at some times. I mean, so you had that, but you also had Baldwin, I think, in terms of Europe, really not doing anything in some ways that wasn't very familiar. Because, mm-hmm. as I said, he was following the likes of Wright. I mean, Wright, you know, wrote Native Son, right? And Black Boy, and Black Boy. Right? But he was very much, you know, sort of, you know, made a home for himself in Europe, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And others like Jake Lamar, there's other African American artists who went to Europe as well, along with white artists. Paris was really one of those places, is what I'm saying,
exactly,
in terms of an artistic community, a sort of, I think, even bohemian sort of, you know, and had this the glamour. You know, there was all of that associated with Paris. But Baldwin also went to other places in Europe. I mean, he was in Switzerland. You know, and wrote there. Some of his work was you know, written in sort more sort of quiet, even remote places. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So,
right.
So I don't. I'm not sure that it was. It's a matter of, you know, Paris over Africa as much as it was. That had become a sort of space,
exactly,
of a sort of literary and artistic associated with it,
that's
right?
Of
literary and artistic freedom. And many white American authors, you know, the same in some ways, in
it
the
sure
ways
did.
That they
it
had
sure
written
did.
About Paris and Europe,
right.
You know?
I know a lot of the jazz musicians were going to Paris at the same time.
Absolutely.
Dexter Gordon.
Yes.
Yeah, they were doing the same thing. So
and painters, artists, the painters,
exactly.
Absolutely, yes.
Right.
Duke made his debut in, you know, there was famous spots where people like Duke Ellington,
right,
you know, and so forth, performed in Paris.
I had looked at an online journal maybe about a couple of months ago. It's called Hyper Allergic. Are you familiar with that journal, Hyper Allergic? Allergic. One. It's presented as one word. It's an independent arts journal. Well, what it was a very interesting article, because they did a feature on Baldwin where they talked about his musical collection, and they looked at all of the what was found. This particular researcher, and I'm not going to say his name because I can't say it. he has an African name, so I don't want to mess it up. But,
that's okay. That's all right.
But he did the research. And he found music, and he tied that music into Baldwin's work, which was really, really good. And one of the things that he did is he looked at some of his early collection. And when he said he went to, this was when Baldwin went into the Swiss Alps around the 1950s. And he said he took with him a typewriter and two albums by Bessie Smith. And and when he did Go Tell It on the Mountain, the book Go Tell It on the Mountain, he played Bessie Smith every night while he was typing. And he said that he attributed a lot of what he said in Go Tell It on the Mountain to Bessie Smith's bluesy intonations and her singing. And I mentioned that because now we've got this new thing about Bessie Smith that's recently aired on Netflix, and Ma Rainey and what was done on HBO with Queen Latifah. So, you know, it seems that all of this, I'm finding it amusing that all of this is connected. And how this is connecting into his work and how these artists were using various things. And even he said when he did the welcome table at the very end of his, you know, writing years, a lot of that music. And it's a whole collection of stuff. And it's on sound. It's on, what is that? That streaming network. I can't. What is it? SoundCloud?
Spotify?
Yeah,
or?
Right. That's it. That's the one. Yeah, it's on that.
Yeah.
And it is a wonderful list when you look on it. He had Gloria Lynn. Gloria Lynn was clearly a favorite of his. And Aretha Franklin was on there in some cases. And that was younger period, but I guess that was toward the latter part. Okay.
I love that what you're saying about music and James Baldwin, because that was a tremendous influence in his work.
Yes.
I mean, one of my favorite examples of that is one of the short stories that I teach a lot of James Baldwin's called Sunny Blues. I'm teaching, practically every semester.
That's right.
And that was in his collection, the Going to Meet the Man collection in 65, I believe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's about, you know, the two brothers, one's the Harlem teacher, one's, you know, from his perspective, and his brother is the jazz musician, right?
Right.
Who is also an addict, right? A heroin addict.
Beautiful.
And in that, there's this beautiful passage where he says, all I know about music is that not many people ever really hear it. And, you know, and even then, on the rare occasions when something opens up within and music enters, what we mainly hear or hear corroborated,
wow,
our personal, private, you know, vanishing things. So there's a lot of meditation between music, spirit, the psychic trauma in that short story.
Exactly. Oh, that's powerful. Well, he definitely talked to, and again, the journal is hyperallergic. It's a arts journal, and it is online, and it's readable. You might want to take a look at that and do that.
Sure.
Okay. Let me ask you this. What do you think is the contemporary, let's go to some of his works a little bit. What do you think is the contemporary impact of, first of all, one of my favorites, Notes of a Native Son? Now, I know this is a collection of essays, but what do you think that is the impact for us now, today? What message is that giving us about what Baldwin was saying about things?
Well, you know, what's interesting about Notes on a Native Son from a couple different perspectives, and as a person who teaches literature and does, you know, cultural theory. One of my favorite, you know, pieces in that collection is Many Thousands Gone.
Oh, right.
From that 55 collection, the Notes of a Native Son, which, you know, which interestingly enough, you have Baldwin, talking about the story of the Negro in America and that the story of, right, the Negro is the story of America. So powerful things like that he says in that. From one perspective, it's powerful literary theory. I mean, Baldwin was a literary theorist. So in terms of that tradition of literary analysis, he really provides a high level sort of example, like, right, of thoughtful literary analysis.
I like that.
In his approach to it. And then there is the fact that even in that, he's really unpacking, you know, looking at works like Uncle Tom's Cabin and so forth, right?
Yes.
He's
yes.
really unpacking still this whole, the whole sort of psychic implications of racism in America, as he would do and as he did in Fire Next Time as well. But in that too, much of it is, you know, him thinking about culture, you know, race, literary tradition, right, and the history of America, mm-hmm. and in terms of this strange, you know, crazy thing called racism and its traumatic impulses, like, right, and its traumatic impact, I should say.
Right.
And so it's a really important work that it has a certain timelessness of it, just like The Fire Next Time does, and yes. just like If Bill Street Could Talk does, right?
Yep, I was going to ask you about The Fire Next Time.
Right.
Uh-huh.
It's very contemporary in that sense.
Good. Good.
You know, what he's doing in terms of trying to unpack sort of the madness of race. I mean, I think that's one reason why we right now find Baldwin so useful and so interesting, because heck, we look at an If Bill Street Could Talk. I love the book, which I've taught many times, that novel, published in 74.
Right.
I mean, it's about a young man, right? Fonny, who is, you know, falsely accused of a crime and incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, police brutality is there, you know, all of these social economic, disparities and inequities of the system. It's very, 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 you know, timeless, really.
Interesting. What perspective, you know, and you obviously have, you were at a very elite school where young men are really poised to go forward. How do they receive Baldwin?
Well, you know, I think here's what's interesting. What I find with contemporary artists, and that's why I'm glad we're in this moment of a kind of revival of his work,
right,
is that often people like Baldwin, who are so important to the literary tradition, to, you know, cultural writing, to all of these things, is that they can be sort of pushed aside in a way. I mean, there's sometimes a presumption that contemporary students know these folks, like, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, of course they read Richard Wright. Of course they
right.
read, but that's
right.
not true. Unless they really are being put on a syllabus, like, right?
Right.
To read. I can tell you that I have been in classes at Morehouse where there was not like a whole bunch of our hands in the air with knowledge of Baldwin or, you know, or Richard Wright or, you know, of Dorothy Rest or Ann Petrie or Tony K. Bambera. I'm just saying there's not or the Lorraine Hansberry.
Right.
Okay. I mean, one of Baldwin's friends and contemporaries. I mean, so there's that presumption. But I think post the 1970s, when Black studies really rolled,
right,
in different, right, that there was then sort of a falling off in a way, unless one was actually in maybe a Black studies actual program of study.
Right. Exactly.
And so this work right now that is coming out with Baldwin, believe it or not, this is a lot of our students, whether they're out at historically Black college or not, first sort of introduction to James Baldwin.
That's amazing. That makes me feel good, because I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this program tonight, is that I was thinking that. Then I said to myself, no, you're probably over an assumption. You know, folk already know about all this stuff, you know. But you're right, and I really appreciate that. You know, because I was shocked. During my years of classroom work, many of my students didn't know Marcus Garvey. Never heard of him. Who? Marcus Garvey.
But how would they, right? Unless someone put them on the syllabus, because they're not born in the moment of being contemporaries of these folks. And if they're not learning about them in high school on some high school curriculum map, then where are they reading them unless they end up in a Black literature class? Maybe.
Right.
Maybe. You know, because they're often, you can sit in an American literary class and not necessarily encounter James Baldwin, which is ridiculous and absurd, but we know even to recently these things can happen, because, you know, the canon of American literature, you know, still undervalues, you know, the presence of, right, writers who are not white male, you know, largely so.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about Baldwin's religious you know, experiences. As you know, as you said earlier, his father, we said, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his father was a minister that sort of pushed that on him, and his whole experience with the, you know, in the Pentecostal part. What are some of your points that you see about that experience and that sort of might have impacted his work in some way?
So it's really interesting because that was becoming a father, being a minister, but also the kind of harsh relationship, right, that they had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he knew his father to be a bitter man, you know, right? You know, there was not an easy relationship, right? But the Bible, biblical scripture, and Christianity had a mighty impact on James Baldwin, even in terms of language and storytelling.
Okay.
And in terms of the metaphors, the allusions that are scattered throughout his work, whether you read A Sonny's Blues or Fire Next Time, right, which he uses a lot of biblical allusions, to tell the story, to speak. So it inevitably still shaped him, even while, you know, he began to question, like, right, the nature of Christianity and its you know, its impact on, you know, Black folk amid a racist society, right? And he talks about his conversion and how, you know, as a teenager, right, he says in The Fire Next Time, being in the pulpit was like being in the theater. I was behind the scenes and knew how the illusion was worked. I knew the other ministers and I knew the quality of their lives. And you know, and the fact that I was the young brother Baldwin increased my value with these same pimps and racketeers who had helped to stampede me into the church in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, so he saw also the hypocrisies of, you know, and he asked questions. Like, I mean, I think The Fire Next Time is one of the most revealing, one of his most revealing meditations Christianity and the Black church and religion, you know, right? Were only Negroes to gain this crown? Was heaven then to be merely another ghetto? Right. I mean, these, you know,
And you think even more so than the Amen Corner?
I think both do, and so does Sonny's Blues. I mean, it's all
Sonny's
over.
Blues, right? Exactly.
I think he was working it out. He was working it out. He was exploring his own fractured but still complex relationship, like with the ideal of God, with Christianity, with the Black church, with his father, who was that first kind of strong representative, wasn't he, you know, quote, Christian figure in his life that held such sway over his life. But I think he was deeply spiritual as well, but I think not ultimately in this sort of confining way. Mm-hmm. Of the Black church, where he saw a lot of, you know, hypocrisy growing up, where he became to see himself, right, mm-hmm. as kind of a hypocrite, right?
Exactly.
As a young preacher recognizing that he was kind of in part performing this role that he knew how to manipulate really well.
Right. Now he did embrace Malcolm a lot. Somewhere, I don't know if it was in the film or what, that Raoul Peck did, but didn't he also mm-hmm. meet Elijah Muhammad at one time?
Oh, yes.
Indeed,
that's chronicled in The Fire Next Time.
That's
the second part of A Fire Next Time, where he talks about meeting him. He talks about how he found himself sometimes, right, in Harlem on a Saturday night uh-huh. with the crowd on 125th Street and 7th Avenue, listening to the Muslim speakers. So he had heard many of them, and he had initially really kind of blanketly dismissed the Nation of Islam, the demand for the separatism, right? Sort of a separate nation. He kind of thought of that as sort of, you know, naive and so forth. But he then, you know, gets a chance to meet the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
Right.
Was
that by invitation or was that just incidental? Did he meet him?
No, it wasn't incidental because they had it was a setup, and I can't remember now. I at one point, when I think about it, it'll come to me. But it was a, you know, a set up meeting that he was, you know, able to come and meet with him. It, you know, wasn't on the street corner himself, because he really did become very fascinated by this, though, by the ways in which the masses of people, the brothers on the street, right, responded to the nation's message.
Right.
You know, the fact that, you know, there was by the story, he was fascinated by the story of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad himself, like, right? And the fact that he could kind of, I guess, transfix, if you want to say, or kind of transform the lives of these brothers in a way that, in some ways, he observed that Christianity or the Black Church had not.
Exactly.
And that was also, you know, very, very interesting to him. So he went to see him in Chicago. It was a dinner invitation. And so he actually saw him in Chicago, mm-hmm. I believe, in Chicago. And so he went to see, you know, him at his, on the south side of Chicago at dinner.
And was that a discussion to get to some specific point, or what was that meeting really about, or in terms of that? I don't know if that's printed, but I would be interested to know that.
Well, this is really interesting. So I'm just going to, I think, because we kind of, you know, learning, teaching, and digging in here to him.
Right.
So what Baldwin writes in his, I've read this, you know, many, many times, because I think I've read The Fire Next Time once a year ever since I discovered it as a teenager, which I realize is really something, because once a year I come back to it, because it's that powerful to me.
Exactly.
But he had not gone to, what he said writes in The Fire Next Time is that he had not gone to Chicago for the express purpose of meeting the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, but there was, they were connected, and he got the dinner invitation. I think he was working on a piece, you know, about them. I believe, if I recall correctly. And so, anyways, they were able to have, to have dinner, and he had met, I believe, Malcolm.
Right, right.
Yeah, and they had this kind of exchange, I think, after a meeting. And he said he was a little, he was a little frightened when he got summoned to the south side there.
Okay.
To meet.
I know he was.
You know, cause, and he talks about, like, I had cigarettes in my pocket, and I knew I wasn't supposed to smoke a drink up, you know, in the
right.
presence.
Right.
Oh, you know, this was like going to some kind of sacred, you know, like sacred thing. And, he talks about going into the mansion, this very orderly, you know, thing, and being treated by, you know, the half a dozen women. They were in the white, and at first, he was literally, waiting kind of for royalty, right,
okay.
to enter. So after he gets ushered in, and he was very nervous. And
you know, that's interesting to see how people saw the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And they did see him in that way as well, too. And other folks I have heard say that as well, that when they approached the nation leader.
You know, what's interesting, though, is the first thing he says is, after he comes in the room of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad,
uh-huh.
and he's greeting everybody before he really acknowledges Baldwin, Baldwin's like, this is so interesting to me.
Okay.
He says that his first impression was that he saw, like, you know, there was a smile, kind of, so to speak, but he saw the pain.
Hmm.
And he associated it with his father.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, he saw pain,
an
old pain that he associated with the same kind of, being Black and male, right, in America, pain that he had seen in his father. And I always thought that was so interesting.
That is.
That was his first impression of him. Not in anything that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, right, but that is what he saw in the, in his face and sort of thing.
I just want to say to our audience, you're listening to the Black Reality Think Tank, and I am your host, William Rogers. We are talking with a wonderful, wonderful young lady, Dr. Stephanie Dunn from Morehouse College in Atlanta. We are talking about the great James Baldwin, and we are looking at some of his works and the impact that it has on different things. We are going to open our lines in a little while and take some questions from our audience. Our call-in number here is area code 215-490-9832. That is for those that are on the internet listening. If you are already on the switchboard, then you just hold on and we'll be getting to you very soon. But this is a extremely dynamic conversation. So at the top of the hour, we're gonna take a break and come back. And like I said, take a few questions. There are several people on board right now, so we're going to take a few now and then come back and take some later. Do it like that because I want to hear more from Dr. Dunn. Because I also, at some point toward the end, I want to ask her about her work that she's doing in cinema. I've heard some, again, my good brother Reginald already told me about you, Dr. Dunn. He's already peaked your whole car. So,
oh, wow. Yeah, okay.
We want to talk about that, and some of that stuff that you've done with Brother Nate Parker and the great Spike Lee and so forth. But we will open the eyes in just a few minutes. And I also want to remind our audience, too, that many of you, your microphones are open, very sensitive sound. If you could just be mindful of that. If you might want to just mute your telephone temporarily, and then when I come back, I will call your numbers. I basically know the order in which you called in, and I'll try to follow it using that order of things. So I would definitely like to ask you to please silence your mic so that we won't get that background sound. Dr. Dunn, before we go to break, and since we are talking about these powerful figures that were around during Baldwin's life, do you think he ever met the Honorable Marcus Garvey?
Wow. So that is a very interesting question. And I'm trying to recall in all of my, I don't know that he,
because you know, Garvey
I don't recall ever hearing,
right.
That doesn't mean that they didn't, because you think about, Garvey's trajectory. So I'm not,
okay.
You know what? That's a really good question.
I would think that he would some point encounter UNIA or either some part of the UNIA movement in terms of the work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's in Harlem. I'm sure.
Exactly.
Right, I'm sure. I just think that, you know, as a, it probably was a little later because as a teenager, you know, growing up in the church, his father was, you know,
exactly.
And his, you know, under his, yeah, father's too, who wasn't a Garveyite, you know what I mean?
No.
A lot of times, yeah, they're introduced to that because, you know, the uncles, the father, you know, are involved in the movement directly. And so I don't know directly that, he would have been as a sort of adolescent,
okay.
You know, directly.
That's true.
It would have been quite young meeting him, though.
Right, exactly. And there were mm-hmm. all of the strong figures that I would also like to know if they might have met. I would like to know if he met Ralph Ellison. I would be interested in knowing if he.
That is definitely the more likely because in 20, remember, he's born in 24, so
yeah, that's correct.
In some ways, he's a baby.
He was
during
he
what
was
what considered the heyday of the Harlem
right.
Renaissance. I mean, he's born a year after Gene Toomer publishes Cain. He's born while so he even when Hurston is writing, Zora Neale Hurston is plugging up their eyes and watching Good Guy at 30, then Baldwin's still a kid,
right.
You know?
Exactly.
I mean, so, yeah.
I don't always like to do this, but I think sometimes it is interesting. Let's kind of put Baldwin, and then this will be the last thing we do, and we'll go to break. Let's kind of place him in a virtual situation. 2021. Now, obviously, age-wise, he'd be in his 90s, so he wouldn't be doing anything. But if he had developed in this period in the same way that he had done. And like I said, I'm not quite sure we can get a cogent analysis in that, but it would just be interesting to place him in time and place. What do you think he would be? In what way, what place would he be in terms of the things that are going on in America? Would he be with Black Lives Matter? Would he been with the NAACP? Would he been solo? Where do you think he would be?
Oh, wow, that's an interesting question, I think. I certainly don't want to speak for him, because I think, first of all, we would have had more writings that were evolving and speaking to, right, some of the contemporary moments like his other writings did. So I think he would have, you know, I think that he's the kind of person that would have been quite intellectually active, right?
Exactly.
Very late, as other people like Amiri Baraka, you know.
Right.
I mean, all these folks,
right. You've been into
you know,
that grammar thing. I think so too.
For me, you know, yeah. I think so. I think it's hard to say. I think what really, my real thought about this is that it would really, I think, wound him.
Okay.
The little progress in some ways, right?
Right.
That the society is so advanced, so to speak, and yet I think like a moment like this would really wound him,
right.
I think.
Exactly.
Right? Because
one of the reasons
in a sort of, yeah.
I'm not, yeah. Go right ahead. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh. I think it would be in a sort of dismay.
Okay.
About the things he was writing about in his generation and things they were agonizing over that they are still to be agonized over now.
Mm-hmm. Because everybody wanted to hear him back then. He was even invited to the White House, wasn't he? I think, well, not White House. He was invited to meet with Robert Kennedy, wasn't it? Did he meet? Yeah, he met.
Well, yeah. I mean, Baldwin was involved in all of those things. I mean, his literature, his literary writing, you know, put him on the map. Fire Next Time was a bestseller in 63, and he became, you know, one of those kind of intellectual, you know, well-respected intellectual literary folk who people look to have something to say.
Right.
About the moment that was happening in terms of racism and the kind of basically the Civil War that was happening, right, all around the country, although it drove him out of America periodically, right?
Right, exactly.
It was a lot. It was heavy. You know, he suffocating, right? Mm-hmm. No, but he returned and he would go to the South too, right?
Right.
Journey to the South and involve himself in some of the marches, or, you know, the activities,
did.
But I think it was very scary for him, and it was very traumatic. And there's a time where he literally needs to escape it.
Because when we come back, that's what I want to do. I want to go to Martin Luther King and Baldwin and Bayard Rustin. Now, that's a hot one.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a hot one.
Oh, yeah.
But there was an interaction there, and I want to talk about that a little bit.
Alrighty.
But I do also just one last thing. I do also like the fact of how he shut Bill Buckley up. That was that was excellent. I love that. I just thrilled when he did that. Okay.
A lot of folk couldn't hang with Baldwin.
No,
now.
Man, I'm telling you, he got Buckley. He checked him real good.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's take a break, folks. We'll come right back. I'm gonna open up the line for about 3 or 4 questions. And then we want to get back with Dr. Dunn and let's talk a little bit more about some things. And then at that point, we'll be free to go with however the audience would like to ask. Let's just take this quick break.
Here's your time for an awakening media lineup. Monday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Oshie. Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Same time, same place. Continued Monday lineup, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Acres of Diamonds with host Brother Jihad Ahmed. 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Black Therapy Central, host Dr. Mawia Kambom and Sister Nataki Kambom. 9 p.m. till 10 p.m. Conversation Reparation. First and third Mondays. On Tuesday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Thursday, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Melanin Live with host Lance Jones, co-host Boniswa Ayan. Fridays, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening with creator of Time for an Awakening and host Brother Elliot, co-hosted by Brother Richard. Saturday, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk with host Wanda Chambers. 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., The Elders of Sankofa. And Sunday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and co-host Brother Richard. Check us out.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Okay, my brothers and sisters, we are back. Let's take some questions from our audience. One of the first individuals that was online, Brother Lewis. Okay. All right. I think Brother Lewis might have taken him a little nap in all of this. Not that it was boring, but he said he had been kind of busy all day. Anyway, let's go, my brother Timothy from Philadelphia. How you doing, Brother Timothy?
Brother, I love your guest, sir.
All right.
And I like the stuff that you do to get him there. I'm going to say to you, Professor, from Morehouse, a wonderful Lincoln man. And
hello.
That's right. My freshman year at Lincoln University, the first report that I did in 102 was Go Tell It on the Mountains. The second one was The Fire Next Time. And it's one thing to read Baldwin. Baldwin taught me how to write. Mm. And even in graduate school, because you have to change your trajectory when you're in graduate school. And I had a professor, he talked about the balance of a sentence, the depth of a sentence, the use of the semicolon. I said, Baldwin pushed that. For him not to graduate from an undergraduate university, to the best of my knowledge, he pushed all that stuff together. So simple to read it, understand. And with his speaking, his one unit of energy opens up with knowledge to take you to place as a black man. He tell me where we at on the phone. The man was like a prophet, without a doubt.
Right.
And I've heard Malcolm, when he was being interviewed in California, and they asked Malcolm, what did he think about the Jews in New York? And did he trust these black lawyers? And were these black lawyers in the corner of black people? He said, he didn't know much about them. But he said, one thing I want you to refer, you can always refer to James Baldwin, because James Baldwin could tell you what he thinks about him, because he will tell you in his writing what he thinks.
Right.
So Baldwin, so Malcolm looked at Baldwin as writing the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved him. I think he was great. He was great.
Man, y'all got a bullshit program on now.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Everything okay?
Yeah, no, somebody was talking.
Yes, indeed.
Right. Okay, all right. Thank you so much, Brother Timothy,
okay.
As always.
Indeed.
Appreciate you. Let me go over here to, again, I just want to remind our audience that your mics are open, very sensitive, can come through very loud and clear. So we'd like to try to keep that background noise down if you could. I'd greatly appreciate it. As a brother online here that I have not seen on my program since I've been doing this, but I'm so happy that he is. He's a very powerful storyteller. And he's involved in so many wonderful things in the city of Milwaukee, and I'm happy that he's able to join us, and I want to ask him, would he like to make a comment? I want to respect that. He is a good friend, and I appreciate him so much. Brother Teju, how you doing, my brother?
Yes, sir. Can y'all hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, okay, good. I got through. Well, let me tell you something. James Baldwin was a very good friend of mine. He was one of the people who mentored me. And what people don't, the way to know about James Baldwin is not through his books. It's through listening to what he has to say, which is recorded. James Baldwin knew Malcolm X very well. They met several times, even in debates, okay? And the thing about it is this, that people don't know that Martin Luther King tried to get James Baldwin to help him quiet down the young people in SNCC and the young people. And James Baldwin said, no, no. He told them no because they were right. He knew the young people were right. And he wouldn't help Martin Luther King quiet him down and have that so-called nonviolent situation. Now, James Baldwin was one of the people who was supposed to speak at the March on Washington in 1963, with, you know, in August with Martin. And I was there, okay? One of the reasons I came there was because I really wanted to see James Baldwin. I didn't care anything about Martin Luther King or any of them because I was one of the young radicals who thought that Martin Luther King was, well, we called him Martin Luther Coon, just to be where I was. Now, the thing that happened is when James Baldwin came in from Paris, and I'll tell you why he went to Paris too, and I'll tell you what he told me. But James Baldwin, when he came in from Paris, they told him, well, here's your speech. And he said, no, I wrote my speech. I'm a writer. And they said, no. Like, no, this is your speech. He said, no, I'm a writer. Why would I need somebody to write my speech? Mm-hmm. They said that everybody's speech was written by committee, including Martin Luther King's. He had to okay his by committee. Mm. Now, the thing that happened is that James Baldwin said, no. They said, well, James, look, this is a speech you have to read. He said, I'm not going to read that. I've written my own speech. So they told him, you either read this or you're not going to speak. James Baldwin, I love him. He left and went back to Paris, said hell with him. Now, Burt Lancaster read James Baldwin's, the speech that was supposed to be written by, read by James Baldwin. Mm-hmm. And we in the audience were sitting there saying, man, I didn't know that Burt Lancaster felt like that about black people. Wow, he's really sympathetic, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Now, the thing is to think that James Baldwin, okay, would somehow be wounded, okay, is to underestimate his strength. James Baldwin wouldn't be wounded because James Baldwin had no high expectations of America whatsoever, which he told me often, okay? He told me this often, and Ralph Ellison was his mentor, okay? Mm-hmm. All right? Now, the thing about James is that James was absolutely and totally uncompromised. The reason he went to Paris, I heard someone say that why didn't he go to Africa like Du Bois, right? Well, the reason why he went to Paris is because after the war and after that time in the war, that the black, what they call the Harlem Hellfighters and others had saved France from the Nazis. So they were welcoming people to come. He knew he could go there and not have to face what he was facing here. That's why he went there. He knew he could go there and isolate himself, and he knew people who were already there, okay? Excellent. Because there were a whole wave of the people that were attacked, okay? The black writers, et cetera, that were attacked, okay? And, you know, and they decided to form a little enclave over there. So that's why he went to Paris. Excellent. And I could go on and on and on and on and on.
Well, we appreciate
that. What I would be wind up doing is telling you, you know, personal interactions, okay?
Right.
Because he was absolutely totally and he had no religion. He didn't believe in religion at all, okay? Mm-hmm. He had no religion whatsoever. He didn't deny spirituality. He was asked in a debate one time, he was like pressed by the white guy that was trying to push people into answering questions. And Malcolm X was in the debate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Malcolm X spent a little minute in the debate talking about, you know, separatism. And somebody else had talked about integration. So they pressed James Baldwin and they said, well, what are you? Are you for integration or are you for separatism? And James Baldwin said, I think both of them are dead end. And nobody challenged him.
Interesting.
Nobody challenged him. Malcolm X had, did he meet Malcolm? I got pictures of him and Malcolm together.
Okay.
You know, there's footage of him and Malcolm walking and talking. Mm-hmm. Okay. So absolutely he do about. But I don't want to go on and on and on because I don't want to just
appreciate
give you.
Like, thank you for coming on and giving your input. If anybody would know, I knew it would be you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
I could spend 3 hours talking about what James Baldwin did and what he taught me and et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But I'll tell you what, look, at a lot of it's on YouTube. Look at his interviews with people.
Okay.
Then you see his fire. You see like his approach. You see his absolute, like he was an absolute genius. And one of the baddest brothers that ever breathed air, one of the boldest and most courageous. Thank you for letting me speak, and I'll listen.
Good. That's why we wanted to talk about him tonight. That's exactly why. Thank you so much.
Well, I certainly concur with that, and I'm so glad that he called in and even brought up the story with the march, because I remember being so shocked when I learned of that, about Burt Lancaster, and it was just such a, so shocking to me. And that I didn't know that for exactly. I was an adult, certainly. I mean, all your life you hear about this march on Washington, but you have to really dig to find out the behind the scenes, things that were happening with Rustin and, all of the slights and the politics, of which that Baldwin disc exemplifies. And also want to say too, since he brought this up, I also try to play a lot of ball when listening to him, because I agree that his interviews are riveting. This is why I was glad that the documentary was done, because I don't know that many folks. I mean, they're reading him, but I don't know if widely they're listening to him. Like in the real time of when he was having these interviews. So they're so utterly, he is so utterly fascinating to watch and to listen to.
Yes, he is.
So profound, so thoughtful. I mean, you're really riveted when you're listening to James Baldwin in these interviews, the way he's, for the most part, usually dancing circles around folks. And yes, his boldness. I mean, just everything from you might be you sitting there smoking in a twirl of cigarette smoke or what have you, right? But yeah. I mean, he's going in, right?
Yep, he sure is. He sure was.
And you just and just with such depth and intellectual tenacity.
Right.
So I love that the caller brought that up, because it is so true to listen to. But I love the sound. I love the sound of his voice. Period.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
it was unique.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, as a filmmaker, did Raoul Peck cover that in a way that you found to be beneficial and helpful?
Well, I will say what I found to be beneficial. I mean, I think what was awkward in that maybe was the, the only thing I found awkward maybe, I may have made a different choice in the approach,
right.
is... sometimes that visual attempt to sort of connect Baldwin to the present, with, sort of the faces of the recent sort of Black Lives Matter movement, because, there are pieces in there, or maybe towards the end, I can't remember which, where he mails in, pictures like of Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, they're
and,
right, they're right.
You know, there, mm-hmm, there's mm-hmm. that in there. I would say that the best parts are when we are listening to James Baldwin, when we're able to listen to James Baldwin. So the archival footage of James Baldwin's voice in interviews is the strongest, material in it, the most riveting material,
right.
In the documentary. And I think that it didn't, sometimes, we feel the pressure to blatantly connect, right, someone who is not, quote, a contemporary person, like their, their work is not, in the present moment, but preceded it. We kind of want to make sure that people get it, like, right, how this person is still relevant.
Right.
And
exactly.
we may put that mix in there, but I find that it's unnecessary, because I think the words and the subject material of the of said person in the documentary already speaks to the contemporary thrust that it still holds.
Okay, I got you. All right, let's take a couple more calls. Dr. Bridges from North Carolina, are you here on?
Yes, Yes, sir, I'm here.
Okay, very good. Dr. Bridges, what is your thoughts on the great James Baldwin?
First of all, I'm enjoying the program tremendously.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that. And the brother, I hope he's still on, too, and the sister, but he made some good comments. I'd like to ask the sister or the brother who called in. He said he knew James Baldwin quite well, too, and I had the opportunity to meet James Baldwin when he spoke at the University of North Carolina in Durham, North Carolina, probably in about it had to be in the late 70s or early 80s, I believe, when James Baldwin was here in North Carolina. And I met him just briefly, not long enough to really talk to him at all. But I don't know if I had kind of tuned out a little bit when you all were talking. I want to ask the sister and the brother about the African piece again. Did James Baldwin ever even go to Africa, Dr. Dove, as far as you know? Or either to the brother who called in.
Well, let's let Dr. Dunn get it, and then I'll go to him. Uh-huh.
Okay.
So there is a... So, of course, James Baldwin didn't, in terms of his writing, it wasn't a full book on Africa. And I'm trying to... Because if I recall correctly... he had planned to go to Africa, and I'm trying to think if he ended up going. I know he went to like Turkey and
right, exactly.
Istanbul, and Istanbul. I think in Istanbul, and I'm trying to think because I thought that he, if I recall correctly, had planned to do so. And I am unsure. Maybe the brother's still on the line, and he can speak to that. Uh-huh. I don't know that. He made it.
He didn't go to Africa. He didn't go to Africa that we know about Africa and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, let's put it like this. He didn't tell me he did. Okay. Mm-hmm. So
I think he planned to, and I don't think it happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he talked about going. He talked about going, but as far as I know, he did. I could be wrong, but he never said to me that he had been there and just had experienced there.
There's a writing too. Is there? I don't know. You may be familiar. I know a couple people have written in, like the New Yorker, who knew him too, like you, and have just remarked upon, him, saying that he, having lived abroad in Europe, right, that he kind of felt, this kind of, I guess, closer kinship in whites in Paris, right, in Paris. Than with African blacks. I mean,
and I was wondering why that was. That's what I thought you all would get to. What I thought was the answer that he had not been, and I had read that too about the closeness he had. So why do you think that was? What is it about him?
Can I say this?
I don't think it was about him. I dare say. I don't think it was so much as he was dismissive of Africa as much as culturally and artistically. In terms of art and the music scene and the literary scene that he was involved in.
Let me put like kind of in agreement with what the sister said. The thing is, like for him in Africa, is like not being able to speak the languages and stuff like that. But also
Brother Tate, you hold on just one second. Someone has a radio on in the that's online. Could you please, or either you may have a computer that's on that keeps picking up a sound.
Because you're talking about the fifth largest county by population.
919-599. Could you please mute your phone? Thank you so much. Appreciate it. I'm sorry about that, Brother Teju.
Brother Hear Teju. Me now?
Yeah, you can go finish.
Yeah, you're very convert.
This is Teju. Okay, this is Teju. No, I said he went to Paris, basically. He had said, to basically find some isolation. He didn't think that there was anywhere on earth where he would fit, And I don't think that he probably was planning to go to Africa. I mean, he didn't talk all the time, and things about like that. Uh-huh. Basically, he was just blowing my head up. I started teaching at the University of Wisconsin in 1969, And everything he wrote was like required reading for my students. Okay. And so like, but I hadn't met him at that time. I just seen him at the March on Washington. The thing I'm saying is this, that him going to Paris was basically because that's where everybody was running to out of the United States.
And okay. I understand that, but yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, and again, I don't think he went to Africa, you know, but I don't think he, you know,
was again going back.
Yeah, I think he's following his intellectual artistic peers in that way. Cultural
and
peers.
I think not even just his peers, but his mentors, the people he looked up to had gone to Paris.
Right.
So he followed his teachers. He followed the people who had taught him or inspired him. He followed them, followed their footsteps.
Okay. All right. I'll take that for right now. But all right. But I'm still listening, Bill. I'm still right here with you.
Thank you so much. Both Dr. Johnson and Brother Teju, what about Sweden? What was the deal with Sweden?
What was the deal with Sweden?
He was in Switzerland. You mean in Switzerland because he was there?
Yeah.
Oh, you said Sweden.
Switzerland. Because he was definitely in Switzerland. And
right.
Well, the thing about it, let us make sure that we understand this. Let's not try to cast Baldwin in this new awakening that we hit, like in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's see. We're trying to like try to take some later day evaluations and look at somebody like that. Nobody was going there. Okay. Now I know that, Dubois went there, but Dubois went there because there was French speaking Africa and people had gone who spoke French to to Franco Africa. That's why he went there. He didn't wind up there, but that's where he first went. And all the intellectuals were meeting in what is now Algeria and stuff like that. But they were basically meeting, you know, French people like Gide
Fanon.
Yeah, France Fanon, all of those. So that's why the French thing was so very important, because the concept that they call like Black Power, okay, was Gide and Bard and all of those guys had inspired even France Fanon, because Gide and those, they were talking about whatever I am magnificent in it, okay? And so this was the movement back then, whatever we are, we should be proud of. And he inspired Francois Fanon and others to say, well, then I should be proud that I'm African, and then begin to write about that. And if you look at G-I-D-E is his name, he's French, and Bartol and all of those, like, intellectuals, they were inspiring people there. So France was the place to go to be inspired by the new thought, the avant-garde thought. And I'm not making excuses for him, but let's not try to judge somebody that came out of that era. I'm not talking about you. I'm not saying anybody's doing that. But some of the people that I talk to have look, let's not try to make a modern person, you know, out of James Baldwin. James Baldwin was an old, old spirit and
and the times he grew up in, but and I'm sure that had he been still been around, and the way the consciousness movement evolved and evolved in the 60s, I started to make the comment, but I think I'm a little wrong on my comment. It seemed like there was something that this whole idea of France and Francophone Africa, because even when you look at the movement, the Negritude movement, colonizers always tend to somehow still be attracted to. Colonized people always tend to be attracted to their colonizers. And I think Baldwin still, just like all of us, still had a lot of growing to do. And I think that's what you're saying, too. I think he had a lot of growing to do.
Can I point out, brothers, that, you know, Dr. Du Bois, fact that the first Pan-African, correct me if I'm wrong, somebody, conference that he went to was in London himself. It was in London. Was it not, y'all?
Well, yes, and see the thing about the thing about Du Bois is that Du Bois, like, when he woke up from the stuff he was saying when he was young, he just said, "Hey, man, I can't handle this." When the NAACP voted to have integration as its national platform, and he argued against it, like, he said, "Well, hey, I'm just gone out of here." Okay, and that's when he left. You know.
Well, listen,
and that was late, much later.
I've got one more individual that I want to call on, because you know the time is creeping, and I want to give some of the individuals that I know for sure that are regulars on our program an opportunity to address Dr. Johnson. So, Brother Lush out of Montgomery, Brother Lush, questions?
Yes. Good evening. Thank you for taking my call, and it's a very good program. You really started off the year great. Dr. Rogers, I really appreciate it. Dr. Dunn, I have to ask you, because of the fact that, you know, part of the conversation should not leave out homosexuality. And when we start talking about using terms like intersectionality that brings forth gender and sex and race and et cetera, et cetera, I'm curious to know, how do you view, and I respect, I want to respect the program and the audience, so I think I'll leave it to you to say the name of your book, Dr. Dunn. So how does all of that play a part in, especially now, because today we have the reality of the effeminization of the black male. And so where does all of this start to pool itself and come into play? You know, you mentioned about the students at Morehouse who may not have ever heard of them. Well, maybe it's because of the fact that no longer do you need representation. Now you could go directly to policies and programs directed towards individuals in those kinds and types of lifestyles. So you might want to bring them in, like Bayard Rustin every once in a while, and maybe Audre Lorde every once in a while. But how does all of this mix in, especially in the 21st century, as we talk about intersectionality and the effeminization of black male?
Excellent question.
So thank you for your question. But so I'm not going to the latter part about black males and effeminization. I think what I want to speak to, because I mentioned this early on, this is very early in our conversation tonight. I mentioned the homophobia, right? That definitely in ways lended towards the treatment of Rustin, who was, you know, friend of Baldwin, right? And Baldwin. And that's not just black folk, but that's American culture and the homophobia that existed. And that was also, you know, within the movement, within the civil rights movement, as we know. And I also believe firmly that one of the reasons why we find that in some ways Baldwin's work, I mean, think about it. In the last, just 3 years, we've had the documentary, we've had now the film that Barry Jenkins directed, of course, on Bill, if Bill Street Could Talk. There are many, many more sort of looks and re-envisioning of James Baldwin's work. I certainly do think that part of it is because as the LGBTQ movement and consciousness and awareness around discrimination and issues of sexuality and equity and representation have come way more into the fore, into the center, rather than being, you know, marginalized, that there are folks work like Baldwin and Voices who are getting, I think, more attention than previously, because it's sort of the time and climate, at least, is not towards ostracizing works. I mean, this is the same with gender. I mean, when there is a period in which, you know, women, the canon or the movement we're studying is dominated by the representation of men, right? And until there is a movement against that marginalization and invisibility, then the history is still being told that sinners, men, and, you know, and people like, you know, Diane Nash and others, right, are not part of it until people do that work, of pushing, of sort of doing a revision of that marginalization. So we're seeing some of the opening up of that marginalization, which is a good thing. And, you know, actually, right. Which is, it's a good thing to look at and to interrogate the sexism and the homophobia of the movement and of the period and of American culture at that particular time, and how that might have played a role into, you know, whose voices and whose work we might look at or not during certain periods, because it absolutely plays a role. So I think that's an important to note, that there are people who do find value in Baldwin's work, A, because he was profound. The brother was deep and intellectual and writes so much, I will say, dare say, and a beautiful writer and speaker. But also, he does represent, you know, for different groups, right, a voice that speaks to the ways that representation in American and in Black culture is also impacted by those politics of race, you know, not just race, but gender and sexuality.
Gotcha.
And as a quick follow-up then, if I understand you correctly, to ask the question, would Baldwin consider the color of his skin more important than his sexuality, would not really be able to be applied then at all? You really
No, sir, because I think that is not a question to be asking. It is. I would take that as akin to someone asking myself, right, are you Black or female first? And my answer always would be, I'm simultaneously both at the same time. And so this is not sort of just theoretical when we talk about intersectionality, right? It's not theoretical. We our identities are not separable like that. And when we think about them, right, in terms of movement, political movement, oftentimes it's been problematic because people spoke of them as this is an either or, it's race over gender, or how can we support feminism or Black feminism or women's rights in a certain kind of way? Does that detract from, right, what we're going through, quote, racially, right? But what that does is ignore the fact that we collectively mm-hmm. have never experienced racism in exactly the same way, because our gender and class is always also, like, right, played a role in the ways that our unique experiences within the collective are played out.
Can I say this? Can you hear me?
Thank you, Dr. Dunn. Yeah.
Hello.
Thank you, brother.
Can you hear me?
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Go ahead, Brother Taylor.
Okay, here's the deal. Back at the time, we knew that Bayard Rustin was gay. Bayard Rustin would show up tennis shorts, a tennis suit, with his white boyfriend, okay? We knew that James was. We knew that King was sleeping around. But let me tell you something. At that time, and we knew Lorraine Hansberry was also a lesbian. We knew that. But the major thing about it was we didn't care. The reason why we didn't care is that we knew that, like, look, we take the people for what they are, for what they could do. Nobody on earth could organize a group of people like Bayard Rustin. Bayard Rustin took the thousands of people at the March on Washington and organized all of them into a working group. We knew what they are. But look, if you are in a battle, if you are in a struggle, if you are in the middle of something, that does not matter. And does his homosexuality, is he thinking more of that than thinking of being Black? Well, he could walk down any street and they would not know whether or not he was homosexual. They would know he was Black. Okay, that's what he said to me. They would know he's Black. And before they know anything about him, they don't even have to know what language he speaks. They don't know have to where he's from. They know he's Black, okay? But in mind, see, this whole new movement of, like, you know, what is it, metrosexual, all that, this is a fairly recent phenomenon and a fairly recent, like, focus on it, okay?
And I ain't got nothing against nobody doing whatever they want to do. But we, back at that time, we knew those things. It didn't matter. If you want something organized, get Bayard Rustin. If you want to be clear about something, then you listen to Jimmy. You listen to James Baldwin, okay? Thank if you want somebody to speak and, like, rouse up the crowd, listen to the womanizer, Dr. Martin Luther King. And we fought, and we didn't care.
You know, I do agree totally with you, Brother Teju. But also, you know, it's a battle. And a lot of times when you're in that battle, the enemy will use that as a weapon. And obviously,
sure. Anything to divide.
That's right. And they did use that as a weapon against some of the actions that were being taken, even to the point of Adam Clayton Powell had to get involved. Or, you know, just a lot of stuff that was happening. But I agree.
I agree with you.
Okay. Let's do this. I want to, Dr. Dunn, I want to get some time to have you talk about your work at Morehouse and what you're doing in terms of the film department. Why don't you kind of explain to us what is the purpose of the center that you are now directing, and how did it come about? What are some of the things that led to that?
Yeah, so it's so I am one of the co-founders along with a small team for under the direction of a former dean of ours, Dr. Terry Mills, who was at Morehouse and was dean of humanities, who started the Cinema, Television, and Emerging Media Studies, CTEMS, the acronym, with a implementation grant from the Andy Mellon Foundation. And the film program is a selective program in that students, you know, apply. And, you know, the mission for it is to really nurture a generation of storytellers who will feel empowered to be able to go out and create the stories that we don't yet see, to have their voices, heard in cinema, to, you know, in some ways, challenge our neglect, distortion, invisibility. But it is for them to be able to make their way in the industry, hopefully with a sense, like, right, of creating the kinds of stories, right, that they know don't yet exist or that have been neglected, that really, or, you know, only they can tell. And so strong emphasis on screenwriting. It starts on the page.
Okay.
Very strong emphasis. Though they take film history. Every student produces in the senior year a short film. And so, you know, they have, you know, screenplay and a short film. So they take production classes and storyboarding and editing. There's a, you know, very important emphasis on social justice in African-American cinema. So that's not something that's an elective. One takes African-American cinema, at Morehouse. Mm-hmm. And one is a film major. So those are the things. And I'm a writer, and a filmmaker. And my current project, Chicago 66, ironically, occurs in Chicago 66. So in the period that we've been talking about, it has sort of the fictional, what I've done is fictionalized, the screenplay that's optioned right now is a fictionalized story that is set amid Dr. King's and the Freedom Summer movement. Mm-hmm. That's the historical background for this fictional boy who lives in the Lawndale neighborhood where Dr. King takes the apartment, the slum apartment, so to speak, who lives like right across the way from him. Oh. And that's the fictional premise of the story.
Okay. All right. And then I understand you're getting some support from people like Nate Parker and Spike Lee. Is that correct?
Well, I will say that with Nate and Spike Lee, as a part of the program, one of the things that we do, and as part of also what is now the Human Rights Film Festival at Morehouse, we have a annual Human Rights Film Festival. We just had the second year.
Okay.
Last year was the launch of it, and we had as our guest someone the planning committee. And as part of it, I was honored to have Nate Parker and on campus for the film that he's just now did that I just read something about actually that Spike Lee has supported And we did a conversation about the, this film, his film following Birth of a Nation, right? That he has out now, that he has now. And Spike Lee was our honoree. And so he was our special sort of kind of Lifetime Achievement Award winner. So we had a reception in which both gentlemen, he and also the actor Omar.
Okay.
I was about to say Power. We're all three of them were our guests for the at the inaugural Morehouse College Human Rights Film Festival. So a lot of times what we're doing too as part of helping our students get the mentorship, the networking, but also learning about what it's like to be industries that we have lots of partnerships we brought, you know, since my time being at Morehouse with the film program. We've had everything from an evening with Norman Lear, with people like Kim Fields and others who had even been involved in his series in the 70s, to showing one of the first screenings of Moonlight with the cast, to also one of the first screenings in the country before it came out, I'm saying, to Get Out, and then having an afternoon conversation with Jordan Peele on the campus. And the same thing with Fences and Denzel Washington and just a long list of people bringing to campus for these sort of intimate discussions with students.
That sounds exciting. It's really exciting. Okay, and then I'm kind of pushing because of the time, so I'm kind of moving from one thing to the next real fast. Bad Bitches and Sassy Supermamas, Black Power Action Films. Tell us a little bit about that work.
Well, you can't say that without laughing, can you? So that, don't worry. My mom still will never say the title. I mean, she, you know, she's Pentecostal missionary in the Church of God in Christ, so do I need to explain?
Yeah.
So
okay, all
right. She's just, you know, she's really proud that it got published, and she'll just like, I just won't say the title. I'll just, you know, tell folks, you know, to look for your book. So when it was published. So, but the title, in all honesty, really speaks to what I speak about in the book. I mean, the book looks at, ironically enough, we're staying in the period that we've been discussing, because I look at the black action films of the early 1970s and the and how the Black Power movement, the Civil Rights movement, and the Black feminist movement of the time kind of gave birth to the demands, right, for these new characters that were seemingly more empowered, right, on the big screen. Though, of course, they became very problematic, but there is a chapter on, you know, the spook who sat by the door and Sweetback's Badass Song, for example. And I talk a lot about both the radical elements, the really, really sort of exciting elements of these films, but also some of the problematic, you know, also gender politics of them, the sexual representation of women, you know, in them. How that plays into the representation of what was supposed to be sort of the, you know, black revolution. And there's a chapter on Cleopatra Jones and Foxy and Coffee Brown. So, yeah.
Do you deal with Pam Grier in there? And some of the...
I absolutely do a lot. And I've written quite a bit, quite extensively on Pam Grier and another writing, but definitely in major parts of the book. I focused on Pam Grier and Coffee and Foxy Brown, and then Tamara Dobson and Cleopatra Jones, and those movies. So, yes,
I really would like if I could get you to promise me now to get you to come back at some time when the time is permissible for you, and let's talk about some more of that in terms of film, because I think that's a powerful tool to use to deliver a message. So I would love to have you come back and talk.
I mean, Baldwin too, right? If Bill Street could talk, we just saw
wonderful
recently.
Wonderful. I got you. Listen, Brother Teju, one of our members of the audience, one of our listening audience members, had a question that he wanted to ask you. Brother Griffin, go right ahead and ask that question, because that was a good question that I think that we might want to have answered. Brother Griffin, would you do that? Brother Griffin? Brother Otis Griffin, you had texted me about a question you wanted to ask Brother Teju. Okay, maybe he's not on it. Well, Brother Teju, it had something to do with the thing that you were talking about, those speeches that were already prepared. Are you there, Brother Teju? Are you there? Brother Teju, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. I can hear you.
Okay, all right. Yeah, what was your, what did you say, the speech is already prepared?
Yeah, about that issue. He wanted to know what was the hidden, who was the hidden hand behind prepping those speeches and having that done in that way? Do you
John know? Kennedy, John President Kennedy.
Okay. I'm sorry, Dr. Rogers. Can you hear me now?
Okay, now I can hear you. Go ask the...
Okay, I tried to put it in your chat. I wish some of these people would use that because it would prompt it without interference. Basically, what I was saying, I heard Brother Teju say that the speeches were from a collective, but I'm old mm-hmm. enough to try to figure out when Baldwin left, and I won't go into all of that part, but if Baldwin refused to read it, my question was, do we know exactly what the who the collective was that wrote it? In other words, who were the hidden hands from the white power structure that were involved?
Well,
basically,
I'm not sure exactly, but I know there's a list of them. And I'll tell you what, you can probably, you know, I look here, I could find it, but it's been like years since I've seen it. But it was all led by the Kennedys. It was led by, you know, John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. You know, the fact that they wanted to, you know, like not let that be what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be really a disruption, you know.
Well,
and so they did all that.
Not to cut you off, but I had some friends from back when Hampton University, the now Hampton University, was Hampton mm-hmm. Institute, and I had heard mm-hmm. that before. That's why I mm-hmm. asked. Knowing the Constitution of Baldwin, I'm not so sure. And then you said the speech actually was read by the white actor. And I'm saying if they're interchangeable, that's not something Baldwin would want to go for. I leave it there.
Okay.
This
yeah.
has been really great, a great start to 2021.
Thank
I'm
going
to
so
try
much.
To hope Dr. Rogers can get us some links to that stuff. I appreciate it,
yes,
gentlemen.
Indeed.
And Dr. Dunn.
Dr. Dunn, were you going
to
say something?
To your point, yeah, I was going to say to your point about the speeches, because remember, this occurred with John Lewis as well, right, with his speech,
mm.
because it was
mm-hmm.
a Catholic archbishop, I forget his name, out of D.C., and they were mad about what they considered to be the more incendiary militant, right? That's the catchword, rewrite,
mm-hmm.
parts of John Lewis's speech.
Right.
And indeed, what happened was that I think Foreman and James Foreman, right, and Lewis, ultimately, I mean, Lewis didn't want to. I mean, he, you know, was not, you know, was not happy about this. But there was King Randolph, I think, and James Foreman. And they agreed to somewhat, like, right, how should we say, eliminate some of those phrases from the final, you know, speech that even John Lewis delivered, because this white, like I said, Catholic archbishop out of D.C. Mm-hmm. and a couple other of the white ones were, you know, considered it to be too militant, right?
Right.
And remember, at first you had these sponsoring organizations, but then you got like, oh, wow, you got the National Councils of Churches in Christ in America. You got the American, Federation of Labor Congress. You know, all of them became involved.
Right.
I'll tell you, let me just say this real quickly, too. What people don't know is that Martin Luther King's speech was just ad-lib. It wasn't written, okay? And that freaked everybody out, all of the powers that be out, because they didn't know where it was going to go.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I heard that.
And I'm pretty sure that you've heard that it was Mahalia Jackson, when Martin Luther King first started talking, Mahalia Jackson got in his ear because she said, hey, you're losing everybody, man, because all that stuff he was talking about, you know, the second hand, I'm like, what? And so she got
plain.
In his ear and she said, hey, you losing them. Talk about what you talked about last night or the day before in a church meeting. And that's where he started talking about I have a dream. So when he started, like, repeating that I have a dream, he's ad-libbing from that point on. And, like, look, the authorities, like, they went nuts, man. What is going to happen? Because there's probably
yep.
a half yep. a million to a million of us there. And I was 18.
Right.
I was ready to, like, tear it up. And I'll tell you what.
if anybody could ever go back and listen to Malcolm's message to the grassroots, okay, he does an analysis, and he says much of what we're saying here today back then when he talks about what really happened at the March on Washington. So a lot of that information, you'll find even some names and stuff that he mentioned in his speech, Message to the Grassroots.
Interesting.
Oh, Malcolm said the whole thing off of that.
Okay. Dr. Bridges,
yeah.
Dr. Bridges, you have any closing remarks you want to make before we let Dr. Dunn wrap it all up for us? Dr. Bridges? Okay. All right. Okay, Dr. Dunn, well, let's kind of draw the conclusion to our discussion and for our audience. I really appreciate what you've done. Definitely appreciate Brother Teju coming in and providing us with the information he had. But why don't you wrap it up for us?
Well, I would say I'm so glad that our brother joined us. I mean, he had me laughing a little bit because I've heard other people who were, you know, contemporaries of Baldwin, you know, hung with him, right, a little.
Right,
you know,
right.
Talk about Baldwin. And the third way, which is so hilarious to me, because Andrew Young said this to me as well, like something similar to what you said about Baldwin. You see, he was part of a discussion we had on when I'm Not Your Negro came out. And he said much the same way that, you know, not that you couldn't tell the brother nothing, but that, you know what I'm saying. You're not going in terms of you having an argument or rhetorical, you know, debate with Baldwin, right? You know, he's very strong, right? And set in his ways. And he sort of referenced like the sort of, you know, kind of debate they would have, you know, a one-on-one, not in front of the public eye. And it had that same sort of, he had that same sort of take on just his strength of, you know, his beliefs or his, you know, intellectual viewpoint on the thing, on whatever that was. So that was really interesting because I've heard, you know, a couple folks say that who got to know him or, you know, be around him and well enough to even argue with him, right?
Okay.
they wasn't winning. They wasn't winning it, right?
At all. So, at all.
At all. So that was, so I really appreciated that. I have a bunch of imaginary conversations with Baldwin, you know, people that I would have liked most to have been a contemporary of, you know,
right,
and
right.
He is one of them. So I will just will end for my part with saying that I think that Baldwin's complexity, his command of language, which was, you know, the most beautiful prose. He was a master storyteller, so that whether he was writing an essay or it was short story, right? The ability to tell the story, whether it was of race in America, something as that was extraordinary. And I think he really reverberates because writing and the voice, the literary voice, the storytelling voice of someone is it has a timelessness when there is truth. And I always admired his commitment to truth.
Yes.
To seeking it, to telling it, to trying to expose it. And that for me has been a powerful sort of mentorship in my own writing.
Beautiful.
And so I will, you know, leave it there.
Beautiful. Dr. Dunn, I truly, truly appreciate what you have done this evening. This is a good way to kick off 2021. As everybody has said, you have definitely added to that. I appreciate you so much, and I'm gonna be greedy and ask you to come back again. And I'm gonna be doing that real soon. I appreciate you, and
let's talk some movies. Let's talk some black.
Yeah, let's talk some movies.
Historical movies.
I definitely want to talk
all of that.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And tell Brother Nasir I'm coming. So tell him.
Oh yes.
And let him know I am coming. So anyway, thank you so much. Thank all of you, our audience. Brother Teju, I appreciate what you have done tonight. Thank you so much. I know this is the first time you've been on our program, but I appreciate it. It was a wonderful opening. I hope you'll join us again in the future. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. I got no classes to teach now that COVID's on. So
Okay, great, great.
Oh, wow. I'm sorry this is ending, so now I got to pay attention to this Georgia runoff, which is giving me heartburn. So.
Yeah. Is there a count yet?
It's razor thin and too close to, quote, too close to call, so to speak.
I know. Dr. Bridges, I appreciate you. Thanks so much again. for what you've done and what you've said. And we will see you next Tuesday evening, same time, right here on the Time for an Awakening platform. Have a wonderful, wonderful week. Thank all of you again, and stay blessed and stay careful. Take care.
Da 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 da